entering the DGTC.
Are you ready for a deep dive?
And Jordan did most of the crap.
Can't believe I said that.
I've been doing this in 2008. What the fuck do I know?
Drawing hands is my kryptonite.
Dark loading up elbow logos.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the DGDC, a united team of design professionals, creatively bound to bring unique inspiration and uncommon perspectives. You can email us listener questions or topic ideas to hello@dgdcpod.com or check out our website, dgdcpod.com. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram or Twitter at dgdcpod. Plus now you can join in on the conversation. We have a Facebook group. Just pop onto our website and hit the community tab at the top. Now, on with the show. All right, guys. Well, we're back for another great episode. We have a really great guest as well, and it all came from Mikkel and a really cool little story and introduction. Mikkel, you want to tell us a little bit about our guest today?
Sure, yes. Thank you. So we have Jim Morris here with us today, and this was all kind of a random initiation, to be totally frank with you, because he has a point of contact named CJ, and CJ had reached out to me wondering if we would be interested in interviewing Jim Morris on the basis of his fairly recent book that has been published that he wrote very thoughtfully called Badvertising, an expose of insipid, insufferable, ineffective advertising. And within that book, there's a fair amount of discussion about the relationship between advertising and design and the roles between each. And I don't want to step on toes, Jim. I would love for you, if it's all right, for you to introduce yourself and share your background from a high level and how this book came into play for you and your career.
From a high level, huh?
Well, no, you can get granular if you like.
Okay. All right. So, I have been in the advertising business for 40 years. It's a copywriter and creative director, so a long time. I'm still at it as a freelance copywriter. I've been doing that for about 25 of my years of copywriting. And during that time, from time to time, working at ad agencies and other similar kinds of firms, design firms and marketing, this and that, I've had occasion to note something I want to complain about, some dysfunction, flaw, some corporate neuroses or whatever that I've noticed in working at these different companies. And over time, that turned into a big thing.
And, yeah.
So I finally gave these problems a name. I call them agents of stupidity. And collectively, they are a big reason why advertising, as we know it, is so horrible, generally speaking. And so I thought I'm going to write a book about that because nobody. I feel like nobody's actually blown the whistle on.
Yeah, not to my knowledge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because I think especially if you're a freelancer, you don't want to do that because you're biting the hand that feeds you. Of course,
right.
I'm stupid, so I'm doing it anyway.
On behalf of everybody, thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Yeah, no, and I think it's important to note, just as a little bit of a prelude, that there are a number of our loyal listener culture that does work at a corporate level. A lot of them are in-house with an agency. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are freelancers, and a lot of them are working the grind at a corporate level and have just not taken the lunge into the freelance independent practice that they've been striving for, some for a short period of time, some for a longer period of time. So I just want to put that nugget in the back of our brains as we speak to a number of these discussion points. Not just to be, you know, overly sensitive to those roles, but know that there are listener target audience members of all facets in that realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And it gives our listeners a chance to nod and say, okay, thank you. Yeah, that's me, or that's me, or that's me. So, Jim.
Yeah.
I would love to for you to speak to that eye-opening experience that you had undergone with Fascination.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you were tasked. You were tasked with assisting a number of creative members transition.
Oh, sure. Okay. All right.
Ad directors. Yeah. And how that came to fruition. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So about 15 years ago or whatever, I took on a full-time job. I got persuaded to become the chief creative officer at a small agency in suburban Chicago. And it was a company that had started out as a packaging design firm, and then it kind of morphed into a marketing communications firm, so a broader base, you know, different kinds of things, not just packaging. And then the owner of the agency at one point decided he thought it should become an ad agency. Now, he came from a design background, so he didn't have the advertising network and all that. So he hired 3 or 4 senior people from ad agencies to come to his company to turn it into an ad agency, to transform it from a design firm into an ad agency. I had never worked full time at a design firm before. I'd done projects here and there, but not, and I came from an advertising background. So I thought that would be a lot of fun to participate in this process of transforming a design culture and whatever into an advertising thing. Imagine my surprise when it turned out to be between really hard and impossible to do, because I was very naive about the whole thing, and I thought, well, design. You know, I'm thinking, well, in advertising agencies there are art directors. And those are the visual guys, and you know, the copywriters work with the visual guys. And art directors, in my mind, were also designers. So there you go. It's all in one kind of thing.
Right.
In design firms, there are designers. And then if one thing I learned early on is if you're an art director at a design firm, that just means you're a designer who supervises other designers. It's not a different job exactly. It's just a more senior level thing. At least that was became my experience. That may not be true everywhere. So that was one thing. And the next thing I started to figure out was that there's a lot of parallel vocabulary between advertising companies and design companies that mean entirely different things. For example, idea. An idea at a design firm isn't the same as an idea at an ad agency. And it took a long time for me to realize that and to try to communicate what I meant by an idea to the designers who were not familiar with it as an advertising term. So challenges like that were very revealing. And the thing I finally figured out, I should have figured this out the first week. Some of the designers were open to this idea. They knew what was going on, and they were open to the idea of learning how to be an advertising art director in addition to being a designer. Many of them were not open to it. They had signed up to be designers, and they wanted to be designers. And they either weren't interested in becoming like advertising type art directors, or they didn't really have that skill set. They had a designer skill set, Gesundheit. And so I was like having some success sort of helping some of the people transform themselves into advertising people and having no success with the other ones. And that became kind of how it was. And then I had to finally just resign myself to, okay, so I have these member of staff that can do the kind of advertising assignments. Mm-hmm. And then usually they'd get turned over to the designers who would make them more pretty than they were, you know, before that. Because when you're doing the advertising, there's a little less emphasis on the design. And you know, most advertising art directors, in my experience, are okay designers. Mm-hmm. They design well enough to get by, but very often there's a final step where they hand off the best they can do to a designer, who then, you know, polishes it up and makes it snazzy. Okay, so those all that was stuff that I learned, and that was after, you know, 25, 30 years in the business, but I was naive about the world of design. And so I started trying to learn about that.
Yeah, and I can see the flip side. I would be right now, after years of experience with a design agency and then having my own independent practice, be completely naive about what it would mean to transition into an advertising firm of any kind. I know that I would. But while that's fascinating and has its challenges, and by the way, dependent on personalities, I bet you had some people that were going, I had no idea that I was going to be required to do this. And I didn't think that that was going to be a part of my job description. I'm not used to doing that.
Right.
And I've been an art director for X amount of years. I'm sure you had a lot of those types of reactions.
Oh, sure. I don't, that's not what I signed up for. It's not what I enjoy. And now I'm not getting to do what I think I'm good at and I enjoy. How stupid is this? And so there was a lot of that reaction, very justifiable. There basically was a bait and switch by the owner of the company. And you can try to sell the idea as much as you want, but some people are just not going to go for it.
No. And you can't force. I mean, three of us can speak to having, you have to have a lot of patience and time to get to a successful point in your independent practice if you're a freelancer.
Yeah.
I actually have learned that I don't like utilizing the term freelancer for a number of reasons, but for the purposes of this discussion, I'm just going to go ahead and use that
independent
term.
Contractor.
I would actually be a little bit more credible than that, but
nonetheless, just meaning like not the free, like we talked about free thing is like, it was an eye-opening thing for me too.
Me too.
That's like brought in to work separately, but not full time or whatever you want to call
it. Yes. No, that's a good little side note. So what I'm hoping to get at with this is that passion speaks to the amount of patience and time that is taken for the three of us to have gotten this point in our career. Without passion, I don't know that it would have been possible. So if you just try to hypothetically imagine what it would be like to turn a switch and try to, you know, even if money does speak wonders for a transition like that, and if you're not appreciating it at the end of the day, it's not something you're accustomed to. The reason that you've grown accustomed to these different tasks in your life at a design realm is because of the appreciation, the culture, and the understanding and the respect that goes with it, then that would be extremely difficult. But with that, I do want to talk a little bit about the internal workings of an agency too. I personally, years and years ago, started as a production designer in-house, specifically for a Nordstrom account that was solely my responsibility. And I was the liaison between the design team, the visual design team, and the copywriters that did a shit ton of proofing. And it was very technical because Microsoft was a huge account for this firm as well.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, after reading your book, what came to light for me was that I was sad that a number of these copywriters that I developed a rapport with and became my friends were not really well respected in-house by any means.
Yeah.
They weren't. No. And at the time, like, we had our own little culture of, we were called e-pros. So the production designers, we had our own way of getting together and kind of getting a little catty about the visual designers. Did you see the edits that they gave us? I know it makes no sense. And I'm not going to send that to the printer. How can they expect us to send that to the printer? But later, I graduated to a visual designer in-house. And I'm so, so grateful for having had the production role well before a visual design role, because I do believe that it's important to know the technicalities.
Even as
an art director, to know the ins and outs of that whole process. But these copywriters in house, they had no legs when it came to be creative. You know, come up with an amazing headline there. It was the design team in house that came up with that headline. And it was minimalist. It was beautiful. It had very little punctuation. Yeah. And so come proof time, you know, there would be X's and red lines, and they would get pushback all the time.
Yeah.
I hope it's better now. That was a long while ago for me. Yeah. I really hope it's better now. But this is a big bulk and discussion of Jim's book that I found to be very fascinating and I was able to relate with. And I was very grateful for that. So I did want to ask, I don't know if the listeners have heard this from both Jordan and Nick about their own experiences formerly with agencies and what was kind of a little bit of a learning curve for you.
Oh, wow.
And how the relationship between design and copyright takes place and what you do now after having gone through your learning experiences, how you develop those relationships when it's time to collaborate with content strategists.
I found that my two examples were so dramatically different because one built walls between all the departments and they were never meetings. There were never times of communication or collaboration. So then every department kind of just like you were saying, gets the what's handed to them from the other one. Mm-hmm. And there's no handover package. There's no conversation. And next thing you know, everybody's kind of at odds with each other and no one really grows. Like I saw it was at a publication. So even though it was not advertising, it was still a monthly publication. Yes. And you can see how nothing got better. And then I always remembered, and like you said earlier, Jim, like the writing notes of things that weren't good. My dad always told me to do that. Like take those notes when something, even, and when something's great too. And hopefully at one point you can interject that. So when I was at my second place and I had a little more seniority as a director, I found ways to say these teams have to talk and communicate more and respect each other. And it didn't make it 100% better, but it definitely made the relationships better, the camaraderie better. And I think in turn, the end product was always better and the client loved it because it wasn't just cookie cutter, same thing over and over again.
Recycled. That's the problem. If you meet expectation, if people, if there's established look and feel, then there's no wow factor. And then the end product and the client doesn't even know what they're missing.
Yeah. What about you, Jordan? Any experience in that level or seeing some differences?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I freelance primarily, and then I'd say like, I don't know, a third or half the time I'm contracting through agencies. So like it's situational, man. Like sometimes I think the best relationships are when designer and copywriter both can do either or at least have familiarity in the other field, right? Just because like there's been plenty of times where I work with like awesome copywriters, but like, you know, maybe they don't have appreciation for like, hey, this is our character scope. Like don't, you know, you're trying to throw too much copy into what we have. And so having that design appreciation for like balance and less is more and like understanding like here's our crop, here's our real estate, like what you're proposing is kind of, so like I've had plenty of battles as the designer in that sense, but I've also worked with like amazing copywriters who like have a great sense for design and like end up changing either like the sort of strategy behind some of the designs or, you know, like it just ebbs and flows. And that's where like having those relationships of people kind of living in both pools a little bit works really well. I mean, like, and I'm always working with a good copywriter is just, it's been huge. I mean, it's one of my favorite things. And if the client or if, you know, if I'm freelancing and like, there's always budget kind of left over, like trying to figure out who to bring on the team. Like I think a copywriter, especially in those early stages, like brand development or something massive, you know, really big, trying to find that voice and stuff. So yeah, it's situational. It's like trying to find those harmonious balance.
It's very true. I have relationships with some of them like to be called storytellers.
Well, hey, if they can add the magic, call them whatever they want.
I try to be sensitive to that.
Yeah.
But she will pull in imagery, not necessarily for inspiration and to guide me necessarily or the team, but just I didn't think of this just entirely on my own. I was inspired by this reference. And with that, she will have put together the framework in a way, the structure of a brochure or a website with the written material, which is amazing. And that just speaks to a bit of experience, right? But at the first time that happened, I thought, oh, why did we hire a UX designer? This skeleton is great. It's kind of done, you know? So it is situational, like Jordan was expressing, because there are other storytellers that just strictly stand by the written content standing alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But a good segue, I think, from here is that in your book, you pinpoint areas where designers are commonly and oftentimes unfairly tasked with conceptualizing a bit of content. Yes. And I know the three of us have been there a number of times. Maybe the client says, no, I don't think we need a copywriter. They don't understand the importance of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're left with padding the estimate a lot because you're not experienced really with that. And if they're pushing me to do this part of the project, then it's going to cost you.
Yeah.
How do you guys feel about that? When the client says, oh, you know, I have a bit of marketing experience, or I've been with a design firm before. I don't think we need a copy. I think I can probably dig that up myself. And I think, oh God. But do you guys throw in Greek there or Latin or whatever the term is, and then have the client come up with a copy? Or do you suggest?
Ooh, yeah. I'll put the suggestion in first, only because, one, I have the appreciation for the copywriters that I use, and they're very, very, very good. Like we said earlier, I think they bring that magic. I know I can't, particularly if it's paragraphs and unified with headlines and storytelling. Like, I can write a great tagline. I can write maybe a headline, but I'll stop around there. I will suggest it, see what they think, have them talk to them basically as a little intro. And I think particularly the one or two I use can sell it in a heartbeat and they'll find the money for it. If they don't, at least I've made that connection and I've done something to show my involvement. I want this to be successful. So I don't know. Like, I guess that's as far as I'll go. I haven't had to really push anybody. I had a few that said, I've done this before, or they have a social media person that can write copy, let's call it.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't want to, sometimes you just have to let them make that mistake and have maybe a failure, but I don't know. I don't want to even get to that point. You know, that's why you want to be a partner with
you
them.
You can't force somebody to say, sure. Mm-hmm. That's a really difficult position. It never happens the flip side. You never get a copywriter that doesn't have a designer to jive with, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen the other way around. They're never forced to to conceptualize something in Adobe product.
Oh,
and put a mock-up together.
Although I know if
isn't
you
isn't that
have
interesting?
Tried, I know if you have tried, but you're right. Yeah, you're right. We seem to be a wearer of many hats. Maybe because I think our role, we're not copywriters. That tells you exactly what a person is, right? But as graphic designers, communication designers, whatever, however we get our titles now, maybe they're too vague and people don't understand the focus. I don't know. What do you think?
This is so relative, Jim, to your is good enough.
Yeah, right. It's also, it's very telling hearing you guys talk about it because, I come from, it's truly a different world with a different worldview when I'm coming from advertising. You know, it's not one job. A writer isn't just a writer. A writer is an idea creator.
True.
And then he's a wordsmith, he, she. And then he, she is an actor and a salesman. They have to be all four of those things in order to succeed in copywriting. Mm-hmm. And many copywriters have two of those. You know, and then they struggle. They struggle, but...
That's a great breakdown, by the way. What you just said there,
yeah.
I mean, I feel like I've known that, but I've never thought of that as the four people that they are.
Nobody's really said that out loud to me. Yeah,
because especially the actor part. The actor part to me is the hardest part because that's the part where you have to put yourself in the head of your target audience and understand how they see the world, what their pain points are, what they think and feel and care about. You got to do all of that like an actor, you know, and that's really hard. Some people just can't do it. It takes an empathy, a capacity for empathy that not everybody has. And so if you don't have that, then you're going to sound in your writing the same all the time, and you're writing to yourself.
You know? Yeah.
You know, stuff you think is good or funny or moving or evocative or is maybe not for that target audience at all. So that's kind of interesting stuff, because you guys, where you're seeing yourself as wearing different hats, and copywriters maybe not. And I'm sure if you're a copywriter, you're thinking about a designer. You think, well, a designer, you know, it's just you're just making things look pretty, and it's one thing.
Pixel
pusher. You know? Yeah, that's right. So that's not true either. So it's really interesting. The other thing that's interesting is that you kind of reveal in your conversation there is that at a design firm or when you have a design function going on, design, it starts with the design. And then at some point, you know, the writing enters the picture at some point in the process. Whereas in advertising, it's the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. The writing, not the writing, but the idea creation comes first. You have to have the idea, what they call ideas in advertising. And that can come from a writer or an art director or both of them collaborating. Then, only then, do you start trying to figure out, well, okay, what does that idea look, what's it going to look like that's going to be the most compelling, you know, in delivering a message to a target audience? And so it's a kind of opposite direction in terms of where who comes in. You know, a lot of times it's the writer, then the writer and the art director, then you go to a designer, and then after that maybe the production artist. You know, it's fascinating to understand. I think we really need to understand each other much better if we're going to make progress in terms of working productively and collaboratively. And that's very hard.
Is that the case? I learn. Is that the case, Nick and Jordan, for you? My projects oftentimes start with the written material.
Oh, yeah. And I think we have all talked about this, right? That, and Jim, to your point, and hopefully this might sound like really good and surprising to you, like, among a lot of us and designers, even our these independents like ourselves, we've been really pushing the strategy part and the written stuff really up front as much as possible. Like becoming that multifaceted version of like a blended creative department and an ad agency in our own practices, right? Like I know Jordan is done that a lot. Mikhail, you talk about a lot about on the persona side and the looking at the demographic and the consumer. The feels, all those things. And I think that's been a really big...
Prior to writing. Yeah.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
the like, discovery phase. Right.
Yeah. Right. And it's really... I find it to be, to me, something newly discovered in maybe the last five to 10 years.
Okay.
Because being on our own, who's going to do that for us?
And I know.
Think, right? We've all grown into that. It's trial by error, right? Like, I mean, and I think we've shared it all. We get better with each project because we're pushing the limits of us as designers as more of strategic marketers too, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think honestly, like to me, it's really in the name, right? And there's just like set by major parameters where, you know, sort of brand building, graphic design, the element that I spend a lot of my time in, it's really tunneled through the focus of like, this is your brand. We're developing your world as your business and the company. Mm-hmm. We're trying to find your voice, trying to find these visual elements that translate this language. But in ad agency, it's very different. It's really like, this is your audience. This is who we're speaking to. So those two focuses create majorly, like just total different parameters itself. It's like
it blurs business it, focus, it blurs it a lot.
Audience focus, right? But I think like the tactics can overlap and definitely, you know, are similar, but ultimately it's like, speaking to your demo versus speaking to you as the brand as you're building it, like totally different mindsets, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Although I will be fair. I want to make sure that I didn't make it seem like that happens across the board. Oftentimes there's what is wireframing that takes place, structural architecture that takes place before the storyteller hits the ground running, right? There is, you know, then otherwise they might be flying in the dark a little bit. Like, what's the pagination doc look like? What are these broken up sections? So That makes sense, but not UI, no design that's been fleshed out necessarily at all prior to. And then there are those writers that prefer to see layouts pretty near mid to end phase, because then they know approximate word count. Some are very technical in that manner. And like I have somebody that writes bios for everyone internally for corporations, and down to the character she has, the number of characters exactly consistent amongst each bio. It's crazy.
That is crazy.
That's someone you want on your team.
I guess so. Yeah, I don't know. I never thought about it that way.
I guess it depends on the area and what the parameters are like, and if there are limitations.
All right.
But Jim, I enjoyed you sharing a little bit about a couple of scenarios. One thing that I will say that I encourage people to read this book. It is a dive into some technical differences and some awareness components. And Jim gets downright very no filter. He'll just let it all out. And with that, he will explain some exemplified scenarios where he will have just gone into a local movie theater and seen a banner or poster, or I'm sure you can't even help it, Jim. It's all around you. You're checking out.
Yeah.
What was given far more money in the budget for design and the storytelling wasn't, and or vice versa.
Yes.
And so I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind, and your experience at Chicago's annual event. What is it called? You've attended a few times.
Oh, the CUSP conference. Yeah, the CUSP conference, I think, is no more. It went on for about maybe 10 years. It was organized by a design firm in the Chicago area, and the theme of the conference was the design of everything. So their idea was to bring in people who are designing not just cities or graphic stuff, or not just the standard thing that you hear about people designing, buildings and all that, but designing experiences of various kinds. And so they would interpret that really widely. And so then they would have somebody come and talk who had designed a way of dispensing water to poor country
amazing.
In Africa, that kind of
that
thing.
So
that's a design thing.
I'm
so they were trying to
a TED talk like format.
Yeah,
was
very, very much like that. And you had to be invited to talk there. Mm-hmm. And it was very, the first couple times I went, it was very, very stimulating, and it really opened my eyes to a lot of stuff and kind of helped me to think about design a lot differently in terms of this much broader kind of thing, a design of life, basically. It's not just of objects and things on sheets of paper and on screens. Yes. It's all kinds of stuff. So it was fascinating. And some of the people, they had a cartoonist come in, and that was very interesting because it's a writer and all that kind of thing. But it got me thinking at some point, I feel like in this conference, we're not really hearing much from language-centered people of any kind. And that's curious to me because, I started thinking, language is in a sense the design of thought. If you can't articulate an idea, for instance, then you can't really have the idea. You have to be able to articulate it. And so that takes designing of the thought. Another example, I specialize in writing taglines for brands and for ad campaigns, what other people probably call slogans, but we call taglines. I specialize in that. And to me, that's all about designing, whatever it is, the 7 or 8 words. Mm-hmm. That they have to be designed in a certain way in order to be most effective or most evocative or most arresting or most humorous or, you know, whatever it is. You could say that you could write the tagline 100 different ways, because they're being designed 100 different ways, basically. So that was to me a really interesting thought that I had never heard anybody at these conferences ever address or even come close to. You know, so I wrote a thing to the guy who organizes this thing. I wrote a proposal to him saying, here's an interesting thought that you guys haven't even considered. And I explained it to him and I said, I'll be happy. You should get somebody to talk about it. I'd be happy to do it. You know, and I never heard back. So I know. But in the meantime, I feel like I gained kind of an epiphany and what passes in my world for a big idea. So I'm able to chalk that up, and now I was able to write about it in a book. So
right. I was just gonna say the same. I was just gonna say that.
Hey guys, has it been a while since you've just done something super creative? And just something to take a break and be inspired and kind of just enlighten what you do over every week and month? Well, maybe it's time to give Skillshare a try. Let's take a brief little break from our episode and talk to you about the sponsor of this program, Skillshare. We've talked to you guys about it so many different times. It's a fantastic online community, and they offer this membership that they call Has Meaning. And I'll break it down. It has so many different kind of elements to look at. One, you get to explore all of these incredible courses. They are real projects that you get to create with the people doing it online. And you support these people. They're fellow creatives just like you and I who have put really great courses together. And these courses help you to empower yourself and accomplish real growth. To go along with this week's episode, we found one called Discovering Success, 7 Exercises to Uncover Your Purpose, Passion, and Path. It's brought to us by Emma Gannon, and Emma has a really cool way of breaking this down to help you kind of achieve new growth, break new ground, and to achieve any goal you put in mind. She helps you define success by your terms, breaking you free from any expectations, things from the past that are holding you down. She helps you discover what brings you joy and use guiding exercises to help reflect on key themes that you can use. You identify personal and professional opportunities. She has fantastic stuff for managing time and money, and she crafts together a realistic first plan for you that helps you transform all of this intention into some actions. In turn, you're crushing all of your goals. So, this is where you can find it. It's all on Skillshare with fantastic new stuff to look at all the time. Whether you just dabble a little bit in all these new things, or you're a pro at one particular thing that you want to become this huge master of, you're a creative and you want to discover where you can find this and what can take you to the next level. You can experience all of this real improvement with incredible hands-on projects and classes to design work around your life. You can do these on demand, an hour here, 3 hours here, whenever you have time. They're totally on demand. Skillshare is also incredibly affordable, especially when you compare it to pricey in-person classes and workshops, because an annual subscription is less than $10 a month. That ain't bad for all of this incredible, incredible lesson. So explore your creativity. Go to skillshare.com/deepinto and get a 1 month free trial of their premium membership. That's 1 month of a premium membership. Just go to skillshare.com/deepend2. Now, back to our interview with David.
Have you guys ever watched how it's made? Yeah, I used to be obsessed with that show.
I've seen it.
Yeah, I used to be obsessed with that show. And some areas that you take for granted that you didn't even know how to backstory, you know, that's the appreciation level there.
Right.
And then what about those examples? I mean, you don't have to discuss the one in the entry lobby of your local.
No,
It could be anything if you want, if you'd like to exemplify. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I don't. You know, as you say, there are so many examples. I mean, every day I find myself wincing, you know, half dozen or a dozen times, because somebody either. Got something wrong grammatically, either in print or on the screen somehow. They got something wrong grammatically, or in the, they got the tense wrong. That I see things in language that are, I feel like language is in the process of being devalued and degraded. And I realize in my chapter on design and the devaluation of language, I'm talking too much about design firms. It's not, and it's everybody. We live in a visual age right now. That's the reality. The visual is primary. It used to be long ago that words had more importance, and they have less importance now. And so, language is getting much sloppier, and it's getting to be impoverished. So we're losing the adverb as a form of word. That's going away, and I can give you a whole list of things like that. One that kills me the most is that no one seems to be able to distinguish between singular and plural anymore. So the is's and ours are just interchangeable, and it drives me nuts all the time. I watch network news, and people are just misspeaking right and left, misspeaking in one way or another, and there's no one calling them on it, and so it's very discouraging. And so I'm trying to point that out because maybe then somebody will pay a little more attention, but no, I don't feel like that's happening. And
Go hand in hand. You're so right. That observation of that our world has become so, well, to extend your comment of a visual world primarily in this day and age, it is also extremely digital with that.
Yes.
I mean, remember when, I mean, at the beginning with creative agencies, everything was print media. It was, it was publications. It was magazines. Yeah. It was brand guidelines that were manuals at that time. They were beautiful books that were perfect bound and extremely expensive. And nobody saw what they looked like online. Nobody saw what they looked like. I mean, you could maybe get a sense of that with an Instagram post at all angles and perspectives. But you know what I mean? It became this, there was this shift. And when I had shared that I was hired for a Nordstrom gig from before, it was strictly for publication purposes.
Yeah.
It was nothing for digital purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, by the time, what was it, 2008 is when I really officially started my business full time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There started to become this transition. Everybody was so bummed out. Like, no, oh, they're shifting. What's this Kindle thing all about?
Yeah,
what's that? I don't want to read my book from a screen.
I'm not going to save my art in grayscale.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And publications and book front and back, book specific niched artists for cover work.
Yeah.
Vinyl. I'm talking albums, records. Yeah. Yes, exactly, Nick.
Huge.
All that.
Even the CD booklet, which became the replacement of it, is kind of gone now too.
Yeah.
Like, right? That sometimes that became more of like, oh, okay, more real estate for visual. But the digital side has just wiped so much of that out.
Yeah. A lot of trade-offs with that change for sure. Mm. So, you know, in my mind, I'm just hoping that this what I'm seeing is a trend towards the devaluing and degrading of language, that's part of a pendulum shift. And that at some point, maybe, you know, people will start rediscovering language. That's my hope. Just because most things are pendulum.
I mean, now it's just time. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but they're collectibles now, right? Like Jason has all these vinyls upstairs.
Yeah.
And there's thousands of them.
Yeah.
And they're probably worth a shit ton. But because there won't ever be an upgrade, revised artwork for them specifically, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I kept brand books and style guides from all the studios from back when we did all these movie stuff. I'm like, to your opinion, these things must have cost $200 to print.
I know.
They were ridiculous. Felt lined, textured things here and there and all that
linen,
great stuff.
Linen, I know.
Right? But like to your point though about like this swing, like if we go back, Do you think it's also because like we are so convenience oriented, we're so headline, I want bullet points for everything, like, right, everything's gotten to shortened, condensed little deliveries rather than sit down and read, you know, 200 pages?
Sure. I mean, that's a huge part of it. And actually, everything being double-edged, from my own personal self perspective, that's great. Because if I'm specializing in writing taglines, that's the most condensed piece of language that can convey a thought about a brand. Yes. You know, the only thing more condensed than that is a logo. And while a logo speaks to you in a certain sense, it doesn't do what a tagline does. And I've been lobbying for a decade now to any client who will listen, that if they're developed, they're like refreshing their brand or they're going to change their logo or whatever, I keep saying to them, you need to be thinking about logo and tagline as one graphic unit. It's together. They should be locked in one to the other. The tagline helping you interpret the logo helping you interpret the tagline. Yeah. And it's one piece and it's on everything. It should be on everything. I don't understand these companies who spend, you know, $100,000 developing a new logo and maybe a tagline. Well, the logo shows up everywhere, but the tagline winds up to be maybe on the homepage of their website, and that's it.
I can appreciate that frustration. I can. I can appreciate that.
Tagline lends in more context too. I mean, you can have it visual and audio. Like, logo can only be visual unless you're just painting word pictures about
right,
it. Like,
right.
Tagline has a lot of legs.
One of my arguments for taglines, for even doing a tagline, is it's what I call media transparent, where it's the only piece of marketing communication that can exist in any medium, in any context. There's nothing else that does, and nobody really appreciates that. So, you know, like you say, the logo, you just can't do it on radio, I don't think.
There's no audio version.
Yeah, right.
So, no, that's a good point.
It looks like a swoosh with a point, and then it's like, you're trying to describe it. Jim, what would you say to the designers, too, to really help them push with let's say a current client that just wants the logo? And it's maybe even like, oh, we're not that. I always get the, we're not big enough to have a tagline, but it's such a frustration. You're like, and so I give it the try or I'll go to my copywriter, but what incentive, give them something to use to convince that client, let's go with it.
Yeah. Well, really the most effective arguments for most clients are just to remind them that, a good tagline, a really strong tagline, is so powerful that there's no other single element that can do what it does. I mean, just do it, right? Yeah. Now, it's true that Nike spent about $1 billion on all the advertising and everything that they've done with that tagline. They don't need to print the tagline anywhere anymore because it's with that swoosh.
Synonymous and that's
it. With them. Yeah. Everybody knows that. But even if you don't have a lot of money, you still, if you have a good tagline, it has an effect. And one of the things I'm always arguing with clients about is that the tagline, if you have what I consider a good tagline, it's going to be evocative or provocative, or it's going to give you a smile, or you're going to react to it. In other words, if it's not reacted to, it's not a good tagline. And if you react to it, that usually opens the door for a conversation or an elevator speech or something. So to me, that these days is, especially in a branding context, that's what taglines are for, is to get a discussion going, to raise a question, to make you stick out a little bit and all that. And no one, I'm afraid, in the business is really understanding that yet. So that's my mission in life, is to try to make that point.
Well, I think that's perfectly said, right? Like, it has such a different impact than maybe a visual identity can have. And also, I find good taglines, as I develop a lot of branding and stuff and working with copywriters, you know, in the past, like having just a very short, condensed couple of words that can encompass the entire brand focus or positioning is amazing, right? Like, and that's where I kind of lean back to what I mentioned earlier, like having a tagline sort of steered the ship to like the designs and all the impact around that of like, what's that consensus? What's that one idea that we do that we want people to know? How do we want to send like the impression of the perception out?
Right.
Tagline. And like, so brand building, you know, like that kind of stuff really does sort of equalize with the, I think, logo in terms of like importance and weight, because it can gravitate everything just by, just by like three words, you know,
right.
Just do it or whatever that might be.
Yeah.
It's invaluable to just developing that brand strategy that will encompass everything else down the road.
Yeah. Well, I hope everybody's listening when you say that. That's all I can say.
Yeah. I like how you said it causes a reaction. I think sometimes the logo can just start a conversation and it doesn't have any more responsibility after that.
Right.
But I think what happens right after that, and like you said, if you can glue it together with the tagline, it causes, I have to react to it in some way because it's telling me something.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And living in that, like that ad mind where like that sense of an idea and this is where I can really link it back to brand building because we're only thinking big picture right now. Like what is that singular, easily digestible idea? What is it? And you know, unless you kind of live in that side of the world, like graphic designers might not kind of dig in that far, you know.
I don't think so.
Where I think on the other side of the fence, like that's kind of all it is. It's like, how can we express this thing in a very easily identified way?
Yeah.
You know, which ad agencies do very well. So I think like, Well, it's like it's tough now, right? Because like we're just in a world, and we mentioned it, but like everything is being sort of simplified to the point of like we're losing a little bit of sense of language because it has to be. But that also, you know, that pendulum. I think that's swinging the other way because advertising is just like 24/7 everywhere you look. Yeah, it's blah, 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 you know?
Yeah,
and horrible. So we're kind of swinging to like, well, what's the most humanistic approach? Because we're being inundated with nonstop ads. How do we reach them? You know, and that's why some of the best ads right now, or at least, you know, most engaged ads are like, can be just a person with a cell phone talking about a product.
Yeah.
And that costs them no money. Yeah. You know, maybe they spent $100 on Facebook and it went viral. Like, I don't really know how to plan. Like, that doesn't fit into the formula of like this traditional method. Mm-hmm. It's like, where does that live? Like, is that the future? Like, I don't know. I think things will ebb and, you know, sway, but like, it's really all dictated by like really technology and social media, you know, and algorithms. Like, that's what advertising
kind of
is.
The Ocean Spray Fleetwood Mac guy. Like,
yeah. And like,
honestly, right? Like, when I saw that everyone was like best advertising ever, it's like, well, did it become advertising out of because it was so different and groundbreaking, but it wasn't written and constructed.
And it's not
like
advertising. Like they just took something that was popular. There's no idea behind that. They're like, oh well, that got a lot of views. Let's pay the guy more money, and make a official ad for him.
I know.
That's it's like, either. You know, that fruit is on the ground rotting. It's like, it's not even low hanging, you know, like that, but to their credit, like it was successful, you know? So I don't know. Like it's that weird transition.
And it's
transition.
Been copied or, you know, it's already like it's influenced other advertising and things like that. And I guess, sometimes too, it's like
it's either that or shock value.
True. Yeah. Right. Or it's, and I think sometimes, and Jim, maybe you can answer this too. When you see something like that as a traditionalist, do you embrace it and say that's the new frontier? Or do you say, screw it, that didn't earn it the way I did? Because I want to say the second.
Yeah, I go both ways. It's case by case for me.
Yes, okay.
You know? And it's very irrational. It has to do with my own biases and stuff like that. So, you know, so I don't.
You're like, it took me 400 versions of that tagline before it got made, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's interesting. Yeah, man.
Yeah, it really is. And that's, you know, again, it's sort of this trajectory where I think it's hard to sort of build around that, or like, I don't really know how to plan for viral other than like, we have deep analytics and we know this algorithm very well on this platform. Yeah. And, we, you know, but which advertising admittedly kind of is that. It's like, what's our demo, who are we targeting and why? But I think it's just like, I don't know, like some of those ideas, it's weird that an iPhone with a guy looking at it can compete with like a whole team building around a singular idea in terms of engagement.
Boy,
I think one is shallower, so therefore maybe like longevity, it seems like that might not, it seems like it'll flow at some point, but ultimately, I think the biggest change is like we're just trying to get away from like selling people things to like connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like that's where like we're in this like weird hodgepodge right now.
Yeah.
Or it's hidden.
Can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
Because it sort of came up when you were mentioning people copying ideas. You know, if it's successful, then you see a lot of those kinds of copies. It drives me absolutely crazy in the tagline world. I have to think it must drive you guys crazy in the design world. I mean, in other words, I'm not sure I've ever met a client doing something, you know, brand graphic-ish type of thing who hasn't mentioned Nike or Apple.
Yeah.
Mostly Apple. Everybody. Yeah. I want it to look like Apple. You know, so,
I know.
So white space. So there's an idea.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't that drive you crazy that they're, you know, in my book, I talk about what I call unexampledness, which is has to do with the first time you put an idea out in the world, that's unexampled. It's never been there before. Mm. It has its most potential power if you put it out effectively. After that, people pick up that, that was cool. I'll do that. And you start like Geico Insurance. And sorry, this is advertising world stuff, but
no,
you know, they're doing this, you know, many different campaigns at the same time for years.
Yeah.
And
it's so confusing.
Inundate you. Yeah. But if 60 or 70% of the commercials work for you, you know, and the clunker, you forget about the clunkers and you remember the really entertaining. And meanwhile, they're all pounding at the same idea. Mm-hmm. 15 minutes can save you 15%, whatever that is. Whereas Progressive watched them do that for a decade or more. And then it finally occurred to them, maybe they should be running multiple campaigns with multiple looks and feels and premises and stuff like that.
Characters.
But now they have more campaigns going now, just like Geico. So what Geico did was totally unexampled. Now, Progressive is doing it. Only certain companies can imitate that because only certain companies have enough money.
I wish Bill Gardner were here because the trend has to start somewhere inevitably, right?
Yeah.
So in way of visual design, it has to start as an inspiration to what is not ever exchanged is how many firms or individuals are utilizing the same reference as a guide. My sister and her husband named their first child what they thought was super unique. By the time she was born, they were so turned off. They didn't tell a soul. They were so turned off at how many individuals had named their daughter the exact same freaking name. So what? How do you control that, for one?
Well, that kind of like educational.
Nobody, if you're signing non-disclosure agreements and nobody's talking about it in house because you can't, you're just taking watch and very close observation. That stuff's bound to happen, right?
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
Just fascinating. It's just fascinating. But you're right. I was even annoyed with us bringing up the swoosh mark a couple of times earlier. When will it stop?
Yeah, I know.
Well, however, the easiest answer is like when clients, because inevitably it's going to be Apple, it's going to be Nike. You know, maybe you'll get it like a McDonald's or something. But like you're looking at these like legacy brands. It's like, okay, you want to look like Apple. Like that will take trillions of dollars in advertising or like billions of dollars in advertising. Like the mark doesn't really matter at that point. You're not looking at the mark and seeing success. You're looking at like they've done a very good job and spent so much money telling you that. So like that mark could be anything. It doesn't matter. Like the logos do not matter with those brands.
It
is strictly like how much they're in the spotlight.
Yeah.
So like, and we're so uniformly understood of like, I know what Apple stands for. I know this just because they told us through years, decades and billions. Yeah. So like a client, you know, I want to look like Apple. Well, you know, what's your budget? You know, do you have billions or are you ready to pull the trigger?
Well, good luck. Does it make any sense for your brand?
Well, and that's the other half of it, too. It's like, that's such a red flag of like, well, we're not Apple. You're not Apple. You're not even a tech company.
Haven't even talked about
you don't sell products.
Yeah,
like, you're a brewery. What are you talking about? You know?
Oh, my gosh, I know.
Yeah,
and that's where, like, digging into, like, finding, you know, and the best way to, like, hop off trends, you know, because I think inevitably, especially smaller businesses, and I work with, like, a lot of small to mid-sized businesses, they're always, like, you know, let's look at some designs, like, in trends, and they're always trend forward, but, like, you know, the easiest sell is like, well, trends have a timestamp. The fact that this is trending now means it won't soon. And therefore, don't jump on that bandwagon now.
Right.
This became a trend because it was disruptive.
It's too late.
And you're disruptive because like you usually find out who you are. You have a very good brand strategy. Let's do that. Let's make our own trend.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they usually kind of come around to understand
that. That's a very, very, very good point.
Yeah.
And makes you tip your hat even more so to these brands that have maintained their
Or they took the chance in the first place with
something. That's the thing. Yeah, they took the risk.
They took the risk at the very beginning.
And trying to convince a new client with the money that they're spending for the first time into the identity or the campaign or the advertising of it is very difficult because they're like, I was just listening to the Office podcast all about the development of the series. And they were saying how when they developed it, everyone said no to it because they're like, it's a documentary, but it's a comedy and it's a single odd camera and there's no laugh track. And these people are intentionally unattractive and whatever. Right. They're like, honestly, and you listen to it and you're like, but one person took the chance and look at the reward. Like, right?
It was an example, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
A lot of the best. Look at Star Wars, you know?
Yeah.
That movie when it was like being written, all the like, you know, everyone like, this is the worst thing you could ever put out. And even when the movie was like early stage screenings, people were like, this is trash. It'll never work. And you know. But like I'd say most of the best ideas are like these biggest legacy brands have started at like that point where like we're gonna put something out that isn't working currently, or like we're gonna disrupt the market and do something that probably shouldn't work right now.
Yeah.
You know,
it had a thousand no's before it had a yes.
And shocking probably isn't the right word from what I said earlier. It's disruptive. Disruptive is better because it only has shock value if it's not familiar, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Literally the antithesis of like a trend. Yeah. Like do the opposite of what other people are doing, but also has to align really well with like what's your
encompassing idea. That sounds so good. That podcast. I want to.
It's been out for a while and I just heard episode one the other day and it's the guy that's played Kevin on it is the producer and narrator.
Okay.
And it's really interesting. They were talking about how they, you know, it was originally in UK and then that was another thing. They're like, and it's a remake of a UK thing being done in the States. They're like, No.
Yeah,
just 100 no's and someone out of the, it just happened, you know? And I think I love to think of that as something as inspiration as to anybody who's a creative, like, what is that new thing?
And we tend to
join a bandwagon because it's just right in front of us and it's this success train and you just want to jump on it. But it's a hard thing for us to go to someone and say, can we break the rules a little bit? Can we try something different? It's always good to test the waters with a new client.
It is.
Right.
But that's really awesome to mention in closing. That's a little bit off subject topic for today, but whatever, right? It still is awesome. Mm-hmm. When we approach our research and discovery phase for any given project, maybe it's cohesive, maybe it's one little mini sub project of a larger project. When you start to undertake that phase, you don't always have to think about what's trending, what's out there, and what's familiar, and to stay within that realm. What if you were to utilize that discovery phase to do not necessarily opposite, but just take that edge a little bit more? It's not the three options that are comfortable. It's one that's edgy, and then one that's even more edgy. Why not?
Yeah.
All right.
I remember an advertising agency we worked with once sent us the three initial comps, and the third one was not only the total 180, like, let's take up, and they had a stamp on it that basically even said, like, if you go with this, we're not just selling it off to you, we want a part of it. Like, they put so much faith in this thing that saying, like, if you take the risk with us, you know, it might be cheaper at the beginning, but we want a royalty. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, wow.
That's a risky, risky thing, but I loved it.
So speaking of risk, if I may, something I advocate in the book that I really believe is true is that, you know, we talk about risk all the time as if there were anything that we do that isn't risky. Hmm. Everything is a risk. Right. Everything we do is trial and error. You come up with it, you put it out there. Maybe it works, whatever it's supposed to do. Maybe it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Every time out, we haven't got it figured out. We never will. It's always risk, right? Doing something boring is just as risky or more risky than doing something you've never seen before. Everything's a risk. We shouldn't even be talking about that word because it's all trial and error. We take your best guess and you put it out there and hopefully it works. And that's all. You don't ever know.
And learn from it either way.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Whatever you can. Yeah. Yeah.
That's really well said.
I like that.
Because it's ever changing. Like it's sort of this evergreen industry
where
like
subjective. It's not a science. We don't have it figured out.
No, yeah. Despite like the trillions of dollars that get flushed into advertising every, 24 hours, we still can't figure it out. Just because it's always changing. And I think people's tastes and appreciation and engagement is always different. Platforms change things like major disruptions. Yeah, which is great. Like talk about like a little bit of job security. That's excellent. I'm all for never being able to figure it out.
I like a success rate. Right?
Yeah. Who doesn't? Of course. Sure. Yeah. Of course.
But I think sometimes the biggest, maybe the things that didn't make the biggest splash are the ones that stick with you more. Because you got to learn from it. You got to figure out where did I go wrong? Was it just the timing? Was it too soon? Was it too early? Mm-hmm. Too late? Yeah. Whatever, right? Because it's like, that's why I think advertising is still, as much as I've never really been a part of it, it's still the driving thing. It was the first thing I think I wanted to be after a car designer, which did not work, obviously. But, it's like, that's why I think Mad Men to me is still just the most engaging thing to watch because of like, it does show you as a creative how you can get better. And I think advertising is that thing that we could all learn from in so many different ways because it's been tried and true. It's been done forever. And in no other medium really has had that track record, that test of time to look at and see. And I wish there were more in-depth things in reality TV shows or something where it could show us the ins and outs of the pitching and all that stuff to me is magic.
You pitching know? Especially.
So like, Jim, when's the reality show you're going to launch? We need it.
Yeah, I'll get back to you on that one.
Okay. I could just see it. Something with taglines. That would be great.
No doubt. No doubt.
I love learning about your background and that being your niche today. I think it's fascinating. And maybe we can have you back to just further that part of the conversation because this show took off in that area appropriately and understandably, right? We can all speak to it. We all touch them. Yes. So that's just a great conversation in and of itself. But congratulations on your written material for your book. It's very, very well written. I'm very happy that I spent the money to buy it and have it here. I started reading some pieces aloud to Jason. And we call it book club when we just start to talk too much when we're having a cocktail at the end of the night and we find ourselves like just not getting back on track. But it's fascinating. It's a good conversation starter in a lot of facets. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Conversations.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. And where can our listeners like pick up the book? Where can they find you online?
Okay. So I have a website, taglinejim.com, and it's got a page on the website all about my book. It, ultimately, you need to go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or maybe an independent bookstore might carry it. I have no way of knowing. Amazon, Barnes & Noble are the main places to go and get it. So excellent. That I know of anyway. So
perfect.
That's basically it. And I'm on LinkedIn too. So that's
nice.
But I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Instagram. I'm not on Twitter.
God bless you. Good for you, man.
He's keeping it professional.
I shake my hand to yours with that in closing. But do you want to, in your words, share the full title?
I'll say it out loud. It's called Badvertising, : an expose of insipid, insufferable, and ineffective advertising. So that's what it is.
So good.
Where's the colon on the front cover, Jim?
Well, you have to ask the designer that.
Man. Typo. Because of the designer.
They didn't like how it looked. They wanted a different looking colon. I don't know.
Like, that's perfect. That's like
it's
the
just relevant. Relevant.
It's
to the
so relevant to the entire.
Yeah, that like puts the little bow on this whole thing. Like, yep, there it is. There's best case of game.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Jim. It's
sure.
Really good to talk to you as well.
Pleasure.
Good luck with everything on the book.
Thank you so much.